Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant, John Russell, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, scientists say expanding the world's conservation areas to help protect animals and plant life is unlikely to be effective on its own. The reason? Rising levels of human activity in and around protected natural areas. Cambridge University researchers studied thousands of conservation areas in more than 150 countries. They found that, in general, recognizing spaces as protected is not reducing human activity in at-risk areas. The researchers found that a lack of money to pay for land protection is affecting conservation efforts. So is a lack of interaction between people who live in protected natural areas and outsiders. Creating protected areas is something that we know can work, we know is absolutely essential for conserving biodiversity, says Jonas Geldman. He was the lead writer of a report on the study. Geldman works for the University of Cambridge Conservation Research Institute. The study noted that about 17% of the world falls within protected areas. These include national parks, nature reserves, and wilderness areas. That information comes from the International Union for Conservation of Nature's World Database on Protected Areas. Protected areas are important for supporting environments with many different kinds of plants and animals. The United Nations Environment Program estimates protected areas hold 15% of the carbon stored on land. Cambridge researchers said their study is the largest of its kind. Scientists examined over 12,000 protected areas between 1995 and 2010. They used population counts and information about crop harvests to measure the effect of human activity. They also studied satellite evidence of agriculture and lighting at night. The researchers found evidence of increased human activity in most protected areas in every area. However, they noted that human activity appeared to be more of an issue in nations with fewer roads and a lower ranking on the Human Development Index. The index uses information about life expectancy, education, and earnings to rate countries on human development. Across the Northern Hemisphere and Australia, protected areas often proved effective at slowing human activity when compared with unprotected areas. But in South America, Southeast Asia, and African countries south of the Sahara Desert, pressure from human activity inside protected areas was notably higher. The study found agriculture is a major driving force behind human activity in protected areas. For example, African mangrove forests listed as protected experienced 13% greater losses to agriculture than unprotected mangrove areas between 1995 and 2010. Experts say governments need to provide additional financial and material support to help protected areas. Experts add that working with local communities and involving them with conservation efforts is also important. Jonas Geldman noted, "We've seen from other studies that if you don't engage with the people living in and around the protected areas, if they're not partners to the protected areas, then making reserves work is much more difficult."
The United States tourism industry is facing a problem. A drop in the number of Chinese visiting U.S. cities and states. Close to 3 million Chinese traveled to the country last year. They spent quite a lot of money. The U.S. Travel Association estimates they spent an average of $6,700 per person. Per trip. That amount is more than 50% higher than the average spending of international tourists, the group said. But the number of visitors from China dropped nearly 4% in the first 6 months of this year. This follows a nearly 6% drop in 2018.
Tourism industry experts say there could be several reasons for the smaller number of visitors. Teresa Belpulsi is with Destination DC, the tourism marketing office for Washington, DC. She thinks one of the reasons is trade tensions between the two countries. With the trade war, with some of the travel warnings, with some of our visa challenges that we've had, we've seen a little bit of a dip in Chinese visitors, she said. The U.S. is just losing market share, notes Adam Sachs, president of Advisory Service Tourism Economics. Something's made the U.S. uncompetitive, and I would target the trade war as one of the reasons. Larry Yu is a professor of hospitality management at George Washington University. He says that people are slow to forget the idea that a country has an unwelcoming environment. The trade war creates a kind of environment in China that makes people think twice, Yu said. Even though we know that Chinese demand is high, the current environment makes people substitute the U.S. for another place.
China's government has published two warnings for Chinese interested in visiting the United States. One was about gun violence, the other about harassment by U.S. law enforcement. In a related issue, visa approvals for Chinese visitors have become more difficult. The U.S. rejection rate of Chinese tourist visa applications reached 17% in the 12 months from October 2017 to September of 2018. 5 years earlier, the rate was a much lower 8.5%.
Adam Sachs of Tourism Economics says he hopes that local travel marketing agencies across the country can help raise the number of Chinese tourists. The District of Columbia, for one, has increased its advertising and programs for China. Destination DC's latest plan is to offer hotel discounts for the Lunar New Year in 2020. The plan includes a number of events and performances aimed at Chinese tourists. San Francisco has used social media to reach out to Chinese tourists. The city created ads that drove some 12 million people to a contest showcasing the city's famous landmarks. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm John Russell. A new study has found that the number of young Americans who watch online videos each day has more than doubled in the past 4 years. The findings were based on a survey of about 1,700 young people aged 8 to 18. Results were released this week by the U.S.-based not-for-profit group Common Sense Media. The group researches youth technology activity and offers guidance for parents. 56% of 8 to 12-year-olds taking part in the survey said they watched online videos each day. That rate jumped to 69% for 13 to 18-year-olds. A 2015 survey by Common Sense Media found the rate was 24% for 8 to 12-year-olds and 34% for 13 to 18-year-olds. The survey found that overall screen time for young Americans did not change much over the past 4 years. On average, preteens spent just under 5 hours of screen time on devices each day. Teens had about 7.5 hours of screen time. The numbers did not include time young people spent on their devices doing homework, reading books, or listening to music. Common Sense Media's director of research, Michael Robb, told the Associated Press that such screen time among American youth really is the air they breathe. The findings suggest a continuing change by young people to move away from traditional television to watch streaming video services on their phones and other personal devices. Only about one-third of teens surveyed said they enjoyed watching traditional television programming a lot. This compared with nearly half of those surveyed 4 years ago. About half of preteens said they enjoyed watching traditional television a lot, compared with 61% in 2015. YouTube, which is owned by Google, was the number one choice of youth for online videos, even among the preteens surveyed. Three-quarters of the preteens said they use the site even though it has age restrictions. Only 23% of preteens said they watch YouTube Kids, a separate service aimed at their age group and even younger children. Of those who said they used YouTube Kids, most said they enjoyed the regular YouTube site better. Robb said the common use of YouTube by young people puts a lot of pressure on parents to find ways to restrict what their children see. In answer to the survey, YouTube said the company is rethinking the way it deals with children and families.
A spokesman for YouTube, Farshad Shadlow, repeated the company's terms of use on age. YouTube is not a site for people under 13, he said. The company said YouTube Kids and its restriction tools are designed to limit site usage for preteens. But experts say it is easy for many children to get to the videos they want to watch, whether on YouTube or another streaming service. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The 1850s were an increasingly tense time in the United States. Most of the population lived east of the Mississippi River, but more and more people were moving west. As western areas became populated, they became official territories and then new states. The settlement of these areas once again raised the issue of slavery. A law passed in 1820 called the Missouri Compromise extended a line across the map of the United States. Slavery was legal in areas south of the line. North of the line, slavery was illegal except in the state of Missouri. 30 years later, another political compromise made slavery a local issue instead of a national one. The Compromise of 1850 said people in the Western territories could decide for themselves whether slavery would be legal or illegal. Then, in 1854, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas proposed another measure. His legislation would also affect slavery. It aimed to make the wild western area known as Nebraska an official territory.
This is the Great Plains. This is open territory. There were Indian tribes settled out there.
Nicole Etchison is an historian. She says white settlers could not move to Nebraska because a government did not yet exist there. They wanted the U.S. Congress to open the area to settlers. Investors wanted Congress to act, too, so Nebraska could support a railroad. Nebraska lies north of the line drawn by the Missouri Compromise of 1820. As a result, slavery would be banned in the territory, but slavery was permitted in the state next to Nebraska, Missouri. Slaveholders in Missouri did not want Nebraska to become a free territory. They were afraid their slaves would flee to it. They felt threatened by the free states and territories around them. So Senator Douglas proposed that the large Nebraska area be split in two. The northern part would be known as the Nebraska Territory. The southern part, next to Missouri, would be known as the Kansas Territory. The senator said that settlers in both territories had the right to decide whether their lands would accept slavery. He argued that the Compromise of 1850 had given the same right to people in two other territories, New Mexico and Utah. And he claimed that same right was meant for the people of all future territories. Douglas noted that in the past, the federal government sought to divide free states from slave states by making a line across a map. He said, dividing up land was not the answer. He said the people in a state or territory had the right to decide for themselves. This right was known as popular sovereignty. Historian Nicole Etchison says popular sovereignty required faith in the American political process.
Stephen Douglas argued that the foundation of American political philosophy is that the people get to decide, the voters get to decide issues, and there was no reason why they couldn't decide the slavery issue, just like they decided any other political issue.
Douglas argued that the Compromise of 1850 took the place of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The new Kansas-Nebraska Act, he said, simply recognized the fact that the Missouri Compromise was dead. A number of anti-slavery senators denounced the Kansas-Nebraska bill. They said it was part of a Southern plan to spread slavery wherever possible. They also said Stephen Douglas was using the measure for political purposes. They said he wanted to be president and was hoping to influence voters in southern states. Opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska bill was extremely strong in the northern states. In city after city, large public gatherings were held. Businessmen organized many of the meetings. They were angry at Douglas because he had reopened the dispute about slavery. They feared that the dispute would hurt the nation's economy. Northern religious leaders also united against the bill. Thousands signed protests and sent them to Congress. Douglas criticized the clergymen. He said they should stay out of politics. In the southern United States, the Kansas-Nebraska Act caused little excitement. Most southerners were not interested in it. They believed the measure might help the cause of slavery, but they also believed it might lead to trouble. President Franklin Pierce did not like the bill. He feared it would reopen the bitter national debate about slavery. However, most members of the U.S. Senate supported the Kansas-Nebraska bill. It passed easily in the Senate. The bill had less support in the House of Representatives. The vote there was close, but the measure passed. President Pierce finally agreed to sign it into law. In exchange, congressional leaders promised to approve several presidential appointments. Supporters of the Kansas-Nebraska Act celebrated its passage. They fired cannons as the city of Washington was waking to a new day. Two senators who opposed the bill heard the noise as they walked down the steps of the Capitol building. One of them said, "They celebrate a victory now, but the echoes they awake will never rest until slavery itself is dead." The new law gave the people of Kansas and Nebraska the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The vote would depend on who settled in the territories. It was not likely that people who owned slaves would settle in Nebraska. However, there was a good chance slave owners would settle in Kansas. Groups in the South organized quickly to help pro-slavery settlers move to Kansas. At the same time, groups in the North helped free state settlers move to Kansas. Historian Nicole Etchison says some of these settlers were abolitionists who believed slavery was wrong, but many were simply white farmers looking for new lands to settle. Ms. Etchison says these farmers did not care about slavery, but they did not want to live near blacks or compete with slave labor.
It's that third group of Midwesterners who becomes crucial, because when they get out there to Kansas and they can't get a fair vote, they become radicalized against slavery.
In Washington, President Pierce appointed Andrew Reeder as governor of the Kansas Territory. Pro-slavery settlers urged Reeder to hold immediate elections for a territorial legislature. They believed they were in the majority. They wanted a vote before too many free state settlers moved in. Governor Reeder rejected the demands. He decided to hold an election, but only for a territorial representative to the National Congress. On election day, hundreds of men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. They voted illegally, and the pro-slavery candidate won. The same thing happened when Kansas finally held an election for a legislature. Once again, men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. Many of them carried guns. They forced election officials to count their illegal votes. As a result, almost every pro-slavery candidate was elected to the new legislature. Nicole Etchison says many American elections in the 1800s had examples of violence, bad behavior, and wrongdoing. But the pro-slavery Missourians were extreme.
It was obvious that there was egregious fraud in the elections in Kansas Territory.
She says population counts at the time showed fewer than 3,000 voters in Kansas Territory. But pro-slavery candidates received up to 6,000 votes. The governor ordered an investigation. The investigation showed evidence of wrongdoing in six areas. New elections were held in those areas. This time, when only legal votes were counted, many of the pro-slavery candidates were defeated. Yet there were still enough pro-slavery candidates to hold a majority. Andrew Reeder understood he was governing a bitterly divided territory. He wanted to warn President Pierce about what was happening. So Reeder went to Washington. He met with Pierce almost every day for 2 weeks. He described how pro-slavery groups in Missouri were interfering in Kansas. He said, if the state of Missouri refused to deal with the troublemakers, then the national government must deal with them. He asked the president to do something. Pierce agreed that Kansas was a serious problem. He seemed ready to act. Reeder returned home and opened the first meeting of the territorial legislature. The pro-slavery majority quickly voted to move to a town close to the Missouri border. It also approved several pro-slavery measures. Governor Reeder vetoed these bills, but the legislature rejected his veto and passed the new laws. The Kansas legislature also sent a message to President Pierce. It wanted him to remove Reeder as governor. Political pressure was strong, and the president agreed. He named a new governor, Wilson Shannon. Shannon supported the pro-slavery laws of the legislature. He also said Kansas should become a slave state like Missouri. Kansas settlers, who had voted against slavery, became extremely angry. Soon, the situation became violent.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.